Hello, this is Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated August 14th, 2017. We will begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined, Senate Overrides Veto. Decatur Schools Will Wait and See After Budget Vote. Tony Reed writes from Decatur. Illinois schools are one step closer to receiving state money after the Senate voted Sunday to override Governor Bruce Rauner's veto. But there's still a major hurdle ahead as the legislation heads back to the House this week. I can only say that we will just have to wait and see, Decatur Superintendent Paul Frigo said Sunday evening. The Senate voted 38-19 to override significant changes the first-term governor made to the landmark legislation known as Senate Bill 1. The governor's changes, which came in a veto of newly devised school funding model, stripped Chicago public schools of hundreds of millions of dollars. The motion to override the governor's veto also would have to pass with a 3/5 majority in the House, which is set to convene Wednesday. The measure needs 71 votes in the House. With 67 Democrats, assuming they all vote to override, that means Republican help will be required to defeat Rauner. The Senate vote is a step in the right direction, Frigo said, but there is still a lot of work ahead in the House. If the state money doesn't come through, Decatur schools are set to run out of reserves by mid-November. Frigo has said district leaders would then consider other options, such as borrowing money against future tax revenue. The Decatur superintendent has only been in the job for a month and said it's been an unusual and stressful way to start a school year. He doesn't know how the future will shake out if the override vote in the House fails and all parties go back to square one, leaving school districts with no funding until a new bill is drafted. But Frigo said Decatur schools will be open for business as scheduled Wednesday and then handle things from there. You can only worry about what you can control, he added. You continue to advocate for legislation that helps education, but you focus on the kids and getting schools ready so the kids can have a good experience that first day of school and beyond. Ahead of the vote, Rauner promoted an Illinois State Board of Education analysis of the amendatory veto's impact that he said showed that the vast majority of our neediest districts get millions of dollars more. But the argument did not sway Democrats who control the legislature. They stuck with the evidence-based funding model they adopted in May. It's designed to determine funding levels for specific districts based in part on the number of students living in poverty, lacking English language skills, and other data-driven measurements. Rauner's amendatory veto would have meant a nearly $3 million boost to the finances of Decatur schools, on top of $2.5 million more they would gain under Senate Bill 1. But Frigo opposed it because, he said, longer-term changes to assessed valuation formulas and enrollment counts would have hurt his school district financially. The best thing for us and the state was Senate Bill 1, he said. Senator Andy Menar, a Democrat from Bunker Hill, who sponsored the plan, said Rauner would rob Peter to pay Paul. Menar said his legislation ensures that no school district would receive less state aid than it did this past school year, a provision known as hold harmless. Taking money away from one district, the largest in the state, which educates children in poverty, and giving it to other districts in the state which educates children in poverty, is not a solution that's going to lead to greater equity, Menar said. Senate Bill 1 results in no red numbers, no losses. Republican State Senator Chapin Rose of Mahomet was among those who voted against overriding the veto, maintaining that a negotiated bipartisan solution could be better. First, it was a massive tax hike on the backs of every working Illinoisan. Now it's a bailout of Chicago public schools that takes money away from our local schools. Where does it end? He said in a statement. The State Board of Education's independent analysis, released Saturday, proves that a better path forward exists for 98% of schools in Illinois. Make no mistake, any vote in supporting the override is a vote to bail out Chicago Public Schools' ineptness on the backs of our local school children, our local teachers, and our local property taxpayers. The dust-up prevented the State Board of Education from releasing the first state aid payment due August 10th. Many public school districts are scheduled to open this week or next week. None have indicated they won't open, but most say they can't hold class all year without state money. A key to Menard's plan is the hold harmless stipulation, which ensures no less funding than last year. That includes a grant of $250 million for Chicago schools, the nation's third largest school system, that lawmakers negotiated two decades ago. Rauner said the grant is a bailout for the cash-strapped school district and unfair to the other 850 school districts in the state. 2 hours before the Senate action to override Rauner, the governor implored lawmakers to embrace his changes and recognize true fairness and equity. He extolled the State Education Board's analysis of his changes, saying it was great news for children statewide. The numbers bear out how broken our system is and how important our changes are. It shows that for years the state has been sending money to Chicago at the expense of the rest of the state, Rauner said. Democratic lawmakers, who ended a two-year budget stalemate by approving a state budget over Rauner's objections in July, prohibited the state from disbursing school aid unless done through an evidence-based platform, such as the one in Senate Bill 1. Because neither the legislation nor any other evidence-based program has become law, the state can't cut any aid checks to schools. No Illinois school has reported that it'll be unable to open on time, according to the Illinois State Board of Education. However, many say they'll only be able to last a few months. Meridian Superintendent Dan Brew has said his district has frozen spending for everything but essentials, not even buying toilet paper and cleaning supplies in customary amounts. Brew has created two budgets, one that includes state funding and one that does not, so he and the board can plan accordingly. They also had a spending freeze from December through the end of the school year because the state had not passed a budget at all then. Cerro Gordo Superintendent Brett Robinson said his district would run out of money by early January. Mount Zion Superintendent Travis Roundcount said the district has solid financial reserves and added the district's administrators have not determined when their crisis point would be. Another article from the front page, headlined, Residents Gather to Spread Love. Vigil crowd shows solidarity with Charlottesville. This is an article written by Claire Hettinger of the Herald and Review from Decatur. Macon County residents gathered at Central Park on Sunday evening to show support for those affected by the violence in Charlottesville, Virginia, where deadly race-fueled clashes occurred over the weekend. The vigil, hosted by the Macon County Democrats and Macon County Progressives, drew a crowd of about 35 people who focused on a message of peace, acceptance, and understanding. It's time for us to spread love in our community, said the Reverend Michelle LaGrave, a pastor at Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Decatur. The event came the day after a car plowed into a crowd of people peacefully protesting a white nationalist rally in the Virginia college town, killing one person, hurting more than a dozen others, and ratcheting up tension in a day full of violent confrontations. Shortly after, a Virginia State Police helicopter that officials said was assisting with the rally crashed outside Charlottesville, killing the pilot and a trooper. LaGrave said she hoped the Decatur event, which concluded with the group singing Bridge Over Troubled Water, could bring people together and show that residents can support and respect each other, even in times of grief brought on by unjust actions. But she also hopes both sides of the clash could grow to understand each other. Demonstrators in Charlottesville came with combat boots, shields, helmets, ready for battle, And the only reason anyone does that is they are afraid, LeGrave said. They are afraid and they are desperate, and they feel like there isn't enough to go around for everyone. I'm not saying what they did is okay, but it's important to understand, she said. The White House scrambled Sunday to elaborate on President Donald Trump's response to the clashes, as he came under bipartisan scolding for not clearly condemning white supremacists and other hate groups immediately after the altercations. As the chorus of criticism grew, White House aides were dispatched to the morning news shows, yet they struggled at times to explain the president's position. A new White House statement on Sunday explicitly denounced the Ku Klux Klan and neo-Nazi groups. Trump himself remained out of sight and silent, save for a retweet about the Virginia State policeman killed in the helicopter crash. In the hours after the car struck the anti-racist counter-protesters, Trump addressed the violence in broad strokes, saying that he condemns, in the strongest possible terms, this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. Speaking slowly from his New Jersey golf club while on a 17-day working vacation, Trump added, "It's been going on for a long time in our country. Not Donald Trump, not Barack Obama. It's been going on for a long, long time." The White House statement Sunday went further. The president said very strongly in a statement yesterday that he condemns all forms of violence, bigotry, and hatred, and of course that includes white supremacists, KKK, neo-Nazi, and all extremist groups. It added, he called for national unity and bringing all Americans together. The White House did not attach a name to the statement. Usually a statement would be signed by the press secretary or another staffer. Not putting a name to one eliminates an individual's responsibility for its truthfulness and often undercuts its significance. Trump's national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, said Sunday that he considered the attack to be terrorism. I certainly think any time that you commit an act against people to incite fear, it is terrorism, McMaster told ABC's This Week. It meets the definition of terrorism. But what this is, what you see here, is you see someone who is a criminal, who is committing a criminal act against fellow Americans. The president's Homeland Security advisor, Tom Bossert, defended the president's initial statement by suggesting that some of the counter-protesters were violent too. When pressed during a contentious interview on CNN's State of the Union, he specifically condemned the racist groups. The president's daughter and White House aide, Ivanka Trump, tweeted Sunday morning, "There should be no place in society for racism, white supremacy, and neo-Nazis." Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe, a Democrat, said he spoke to Trump in the hours after the clashes, and that he twice told the president, "We have to stop this hateful speech, this rhetoric." He said he urged Trump to come out stronger against the actions of white supremacists. On Saturday, Republicans joined Democrats in criticizing the president for not specifically calling out white nationalists. Senator Cory Gardner, Republican from Colorado, tweeted, "Mr. President, we must call evil by its name. These were white supremacists, and this was domestic terrorism." Added Senator Marco Rubio, Republican of Florida, "Nothing patriotic about hashtag Nazis, the hashtag KKK, or hashtag white supremacists. It's the direct opposite of what America seeks to be." The president did not have any public events on Sunday. White House staff did not share any information on his activities, except that he and his staff were monitoring the aftermath of the violence in Virginia. White nationalists had assembled in Charlottesville to vent their frustration against the city's plans to take down a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. Counter-protesters massed in opposition. Alt-right leader Richard Spencer and former Ku Klux Klan member David Duke attended the demonstrations. Duke told reporters that the white nationalists were working to fulfill the promises of Donald Trump. Trump's initial comments drew praise from the neo-Nazi website Daily Stormer, which wrote, "Trump comments were good. He didn't attack us. He just said the nation should come together, nothing specific against us. No condemnation at all." The website had been promoting the Charlottesville demonstration as part of its Summer of Hate. Charlottesville Mayor Michael Singer, a Democrat, slammed Trump's stance toward hate groups, saying on NBC's Meet the Press that he hopes Trump looks himself in the mirror and thinks very deeply about who he consorted with. Old saying, when you dance with the devil doesn't change, the devil changes you, Singer said. Trump, as a presidential candidate, frequently came under scrutiny for being slow to offer his condemnation of white supremacists. His strongest denunciation of the movement has not come voluntarily, only when asked, and he occasionally trafficked in retweets of racist social media posts during his campaign. His chief strategist, Steve Bannon, once declared that his former news site, Breitbart, was the platform for the alt-right. At the Vigil in Decatur, Peter Smith Phillips, a member of the Macon County Progressives who helped organize the event, said it's a big enough community to show support for the people of Charlottesville. He saw the list of vigils being held and thought Decatur should be on the list. He said he wanted to show the people of Charlottesville they should not feel alone. They did the best they could to stand up, and the most unfortunate thing happened, and we need to stand with them as a country and show that this is not acceptable, Smith Phillips said. He said he was surprised to see the torches the white supremacists carried in footage of the protests, as well as the number of neo-Nazis, supremacists, and KKK members who demonstrated. I think that is the biggest takeaway from yesterday, is people were sticking up for what they believed in, and their lives were taken for it, said Jen McMillan, an event organizer with the Macon County Democrats. One message McMillan hoped attendees would take away from the event, at the end of the day, people need to show respect for each other, even when they disagree. And while it will hurt sometimes to hear things we don't like, we still have to listen to other people when they say them. And continuing on the front page, an article by Tony Reed from the Herald and Review. Shop with a Cop Lends Hand to Kids. This article is from Forsyth. 6-year-old Brylan Flournoy suddenly faced one of those tense fashion moments that can crop up in any young man's life. Do I go with action-themed underwear for the ultimate back-to-school chic? Brylan, shopping the Kohl's store in Forsyth's Hickory Point Mall, in the end opted for just plain shorts, perhaps reflecting a growing sense of maturity. But it's always nice to have options, and thanks to the Decatur Police Shop with a Cop Back to School program, more than 80 kids aged from kindergarten through 8th grade got to arrest their favorite style choices. The event is organized by the Decatur Police Benevolent Association, comprised of active duty officers and retirees. The association reaches out to the community to do good works and show people another side of the men and women who work in law enforcement. Its oldest community outreach program is the Christmas Shop with a Cop event that now partners with Target to buy gifts for families in need and dates back some 20 years. The back-to-school version is now in its 4th year and came to be after cops spotted another occasion that could benefit from the long arm of the law reaching out with a helping hand. Business and community donations raise the roughly $9,000 cost that pays for each child to receive $100 worth of new clothes and shoes. A team of 30 officers, dispatchers, and other helpers accompany the families who presented themselves in 2 shifts at Kohl's at 9 a.m. and 10:15 a.m. to do their shopping in private. The store helps the shopping dollars go further with a healthy discount, and the police also provide drinks and donuts, as well as backpacks donated by the Decatur YMCA. Names of deserving families are forwarded in advance by schools and organizations like the Decatur Boys and Girls Club. Sergeant Scott Rosenberry, president of the Decatur Police Benevolent Association, said it's a win-win for everyone. The kids get some high-quality clothing, and it is good for the officers and the kids to start interacting and getting to know each other, he said. It's just a good thing overall. Sergeant Toby Williams with the Street Crimes Narcotics Unit was handling the shopping interaction with Brylan, ably assisted by Williams' own 8-year-old son, Aiden. As they marched on from the underwear to investigate other clothing choices, Sergeant Williams was feeling relaxed. Here, you see everyone on a personal level. You are not dealing with people in their most extreme times, he said, contrasting the shopping experience with his regular job. This is really nice. And moving to the local page, we have an article by Donette Beckett. Oscars for Quilters. Decatur women earn spot in international show. From Decatur. One of the highest honors for a quilter is to have their work shown in Paducah, Kentucky, during the American Quilter Society show. The Decatur Quilters Guild has the privilege of sending 2 members to the popular competition this year. Mary Traxler of Hammond and Linda Bowles of Decatur will have their quilts displayed in the international show, September 13th to 16th. To be selected is an honor, but to have 2 quilters from the same guild is an especially warm recognition. Everybody who knows quilting knows about Paducah, Bowles said. It's like the Academy Awards for quilters. Bowles' quilt, titled International Sunbonnet Sioux, and Traxler's Quilt of Many Colors, will be 2 of the 550 quilts displayed. More than $120,000 in prizes will be awarded to 15 winners. Countries represented at International Quilt Show include Japan, New Zealand, Australia, and England, as well as 41 states. They use different techniques and the designs are across the board, Bowles said. After more than 30 years, the quilting competition has grown, motivating organizers to expand. This will be the first fall show. Traxler and Bowles have attended the spring show for 4 years and have experienced crowds of 30,000 people. Nearly 140 vendors are also part of the show, selling everything associated with quilts, including sewing machines, fabrics, thread, and patterns. Anything your heart desires, Traxler said. The women say the quilting show is important as the craft continues to grow as an art form. You can't get a hotel within 100 miles, Bowles said. The Paducah competition is fierce, Bowles and Traxler agreed. 3 certified international judges will critique each of the quilts beginning 2 weeks before the show. The best of show will be voted on by the competition's quilters through online voting. Other American Quilters Society competitions throughout the year, including Virginia Beach, Virginia, Daytona, Florida, and Grand Rapids, Michigan. You think you have seen the most beautiful quilt, and then you go around the corner, and there is another, Bowles said. Neither Traxler nor Bowles had ever entered a quilt in the international competition. Both ladies knew they had special quilts when they finished the work, though. Each took about 1.5 years to complete their work. Traxler enlisted the help of Joy Voltenberg of Sullivan to piece together the quilt. She turned it into something beautiful, Traxler said. Quilters attend the competition not only to view beautiful pieces of work, but also to learn more about their craft. On the first day of the show, competitors will stand with their quilts answering questions about the designs and techniques. Quilters are very generous in their knowledge, Bowles said. We are all teachers at heart, Traxler said. Both ladies began quilting later in life. Bowles watched as her grandmothers quilted, but didn't take up the craft until she decided to make a quilt for her in-laws. It wasn't great, she said. It was tied, not quilted. I didn't know anything about quilting. Traxler learned some stitching techniques from her mother as a child, but didn't start seriously quilting until she was an adult. Once they found an interest, both ladies took quilting classes to learn more. You learn from the experts, from each other, Bowles said. I learned from books, too, Traxler said. The quilters use the techniques in which they feel most comfortable. Both competition quilts were created using hand appliqué. Traxler uses needle-turn appliqué, while Bowles uses prepared appliqué. Each is a different technique, but with the same result. It takes more concentration to do a hand appliqué than it does to do anything else, Traxler said. It is the top of the line. The prestige of getting a quilt in the Paducah show, it is a tremendous honor, Traxler said. And a photo accompanies this article showing Linda Bowles and Mary Traxler pictured with their quilts, fabulous, colorful quilts that have been selected for the upcoming International American Quilters Society show in Paducah, Kentucky. As noted in the article, Linda Bowles' quilt is titled International Sunbonnet Sue and has lots of different versions of the little girl in sunbonnets. And Traxler's quilt is the quilt of many colors, and it is a riot of bright, wonderful colors, flowers in a basket, and just lovely. Also from the local page, Eastern Illinois numbers drop a bit. From Charleston, new projections reveal Eastern Illinois University's enrollment likely will decline again this year, but at a slower pace than previous years. Josh Norman, Associate Vice President for Enrollment Management, said current numbers for the fall semester forecast the lowest decline in EIU enrollment in 5 years. This is a stark difference from last year's numbers, which had the largest deficit in enrollment in comparison to that of recent years. According to the early numbers, the incoming freshman rolls are still on the decline for this fall. Norman said the freshman class doesn't look big enough to make up for the large graduating class that left the university in the spring. While the freshman class is likely to see a dip, other student populations are expected to go up. Based on other indicators, transfer, graduate, and international student numbers will be up. Norman noted that these numbers are still in flux until students start classes, but they are looking good relative to the situation EIU and other universities had to wade through. Norman said the end of the state's budget impasse came too late to have a positive impact on fall enrollment. Norman noted that on more than one occasion, students who showed interest in EIU said they wished the state budget impasse was resolved sooner, before they locked in their choice to another university. It takes time to reshape the view of uncertainty in Illinois higher education that the impasse left, he said. Norman said the admissions team has received thousands more inquiries than we had this time last year for the next enrollment cycle. Official enrollment numbers will be released on the 10th day of the fall semester. And from the news briefs on the local page from Decatur, witnesses report shots fired, no casings found. Several witnesses called police Saturday afternoon to report multiple shots fired in the 800 block of West Packard Street. Sergeant Timothy Maxwell said the callers described a man getting out of a silver-colored car around 2:20 p.m. and firing approximately 5 gunshots. We don't know if he was shooting in the air or shooting at someone, Maxwell said. Officers who checked the area found no obvious bullet damage and no shell casings. And from Decatur, careless driving in semi tip on entry ramp. A woman semi-truck driver was cited for careless driving Saturday morning after her truck tipped over, heading down the westbound entry ramp to Interstate 72 off of US 51. Sergeant Timothy Maxwell said the ramp was blocked for a time while emergency crews righted the truck and cleaned up its spilled cargo of cooking oil packages. The driver was injured and treated in hospital for injuries that Maxwell said were not serious. And we'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, August 14th, 2017. Please stay tuned.